Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
And what a relief. I'm not going to give a lecture. I'm going to respond to questions and try not to run off too long at the responses so that we can have really a dialogue. I've been married to a doctor for 28 years. And dated her for several years before that as she was training to be a doctor, including once fainting when I went on rounds with her, which determined that I would not be a doctor, by the way. But a lot of what I'm doing is, in a way, being a wannabe doctor in the sense that when I have watched my wife, Sonia, be the superb clinician that she is, it is taking a problem, it's usually a set of symptoms of a patient, and applying a very systematic, analytical, and science-based framework, and also a set of remarkable human skills to try to understand what to do effectively to help the child, she's a pediatrician, what to do to help the family, because there often are familial or social conditions that are really lurking behind a particular case. When I watched this over the years, I was amazed at many things. You know, I went with her to a talk, in this case it was about head injuries, and one thing that impressed me that would never happen in economics where the doctor said, we used to do the following, but since last month such and such article came out, now we do something else. Can you imagine in economics actually looking at a scientific paper and saying, okay, now we do something else? Impossible. Because it's so much attitude, views, and prejudices, and so on. But it impressed me, and does impress me, how good modern medical treatment is rigorously science-based, though there are huge unknowns. It is algorithmic often in the following sense that, and I've listened to it 100 times, a call comes in the middle of the night, probably 1,000 times. My child has a fever. And that is the beginning of a long analysis. And it always starts out the same way. By the way, you ask a series of questions, but they're not asked in random order. First, you have to rule out meningitis, for example, because if it is meningitis, you've got to get them to an emergency room immediately. So is the neck stiff, and so on. So you go through a certain sequence of questions, and it's scientific, it's methodical, it's going down a whole decision tree to try to figure out what the underlying symptoms, what the underlying conditions might be. Of course, there's only so much that the questions can do. There's also possibly going to be a lot of analysis. Another thing that always impressed me about this is that the pickup of a condition that saves a child's life, my wife would put down the phone and say, you know, that mother usually is not so concerned like that. Something's not right. And that's why I said, meet me in the emergency room. And it isn't just a diagnosis. It's also all of the subtle cues, the knowledge of the whole family dynamic. Of course, most of these things, the modern American healthcare system has systematically eliminated, by the way. So we're breaking a lot of the deep art and science that actually gets done in many cases. But watching this, to now return to your question, led me to the hope that what we do in the area of international development or the various activities that I've been engaged in specific reform challenges or a specific crisis, a crisis of malaria or a crisis of hyperinflation or a crisis of unpayable debt could be susceptible of rigorous analysis, heavy knowledge of context, differential diagnosis, because the same thing that you see is quite different in different places, and a systematic response that is worthy of this label social science, which is often very much ill-deserved. So I am trying to be a problem solver and view the kind of economics that I'm doing and engaged in, and more broadly, the kind of problem solving that I'm engaged in with colleagues from many disciplines, to be a professional action linking underlying knowledge to specific contexts and trying to find solutions, and to try to build a both a base of knowledge that is truly comparative, has concepts underlying the actions that are as rigorous and continuing to be developed as possible. And I would add one more thing that I think all professions need, and that is an ethical set of standards and norms about what proper ethical practice means. Within that, I've been engaged in all sorts of things, and I've never known exactly what I was going to be engaged in next, because the other way that I've found life to be interesting, fulfilling, and professionally most productive is not to plan for too long and too far ahead exactly what it is you're going to be called upon to do. I went into economics not as a theoretical discipline, but as a what I hoped would be a set of tools for problem solving. And I trained as a monetary economist and started work on a monetary problem, which is hyperinflation. And then because hyperinflation comes packaged necessarily with other kinds of problems, naturally became interested not only in the solution to the immediate crisis, which in a hyperinflation is almost inevitably about money and budgets, but to step back and say that those problems arose because of a broader context, social, political, and in my opinion, geographical, playing a large role. And the more I looked, every time I found another strand that I thought was important, I took the opportunity to try to learn about it. And also, each strand pulled me to another unexpected professional activity. And so from Bolivia to Eastern Europe was completely accidental for me, except for the fact that the problem in Bolivia that I helped to address of a debt crisis was a problem that Poland similarly had. And when Poland was going through its transition from communist dictatorship to post-communist democracy, I had the unbelievable good luck to be asked to do something to help, because I had done something for Bolivia on debt, and that was the link, but not the most obvious link, by the way. I was not a specialist in communist economies or in Eastern Europe and whatever, but I was, to an extent, a practical specialist in how to get debt canceled, and so I was asked to do that and found a weird thing, by the way, which I can tell all of you as you get engaged in these things. I was found myself at the epicenter of the revolutions of 1989, one of the pivotal moments on our planet of revolutionary change, like 1789, but this was 1989. And communism was collapsing. The same day as the Tiananmen massacre was the Polish election, and I was the only non-Polish outsider around, which is another weird thing, because there was actually no more interesting place on the whole planet than to be in Central Europe at that moment. And you might have thought that busloads of economists would be trundling in, or airplane loads of people wanting to see what was going on or getting involved. But life isn't like that for some strange reason. And for a year or two, just odd as it was, these momentous historic events were taking place, and I happened to have a good chance to be a participant and also a front row observer simultaneously. And life is like that in funny ways. So keep your eyes open and don't overplan, because you'll miss the big things that will be the most interesting, fun, exciting learning experiences that you can have. I always found one more thing, just a little advice if I could. When I was in Bolivia working in 1985, I was a bit of a kid then, from the point of view of working on problems like this. I was 29, I was 30 that summer. This was a massive hyperinflation and huge crisis. But Bolivia is a landlocked, poor country in the middle of South America. And there was, again, even though it was the first hyperinflation on the planet since the Chinese Revolution, since 1949, and from the point of view of a textbook or an extraordinary economic event, a once-in-a-generation phenomenon that is so momentous and so fascinating intellectually, by the way, but so momentous, you'd think that there would be the highest level of interest because it was an impoverished little country that no one cared about. Actually, no one was there, again, and no one caring and no one doing anything. And so that's why they took this kid, I suppose, because it wasn't seen as somehow an important event on the planet. It was just some faraway little country that was known to be in a lot of difficulty. I thought at the time, and I think, again, even in retrospect, that it had such pertinent things to teach, as well as the importance for the Bolivian people themselves, about the nature of crisis in our time, about the debt crisis, because a lot of Bolivia's crisis was the foreign debt crisis that was being disastrously managed by Washington at the time, that it should have been the highest level of concern, but it was just considered a complete backwater. A lot of the situation and crisis in Africa is treated the same way. The AIDS pandemic, the largest pandemic in modern history, was a footnote from the point of view of the world, really, until very, very recently, just odd as could be. And when I started working in Africa, even as much as AIDS, the thing that completely overwhelmed me that I didn't expect was the burden of malaria, which for me was a word out of a history book, not a live concern. I had never really thought about it before. And all of a sudden, there's malaria everywhere, and kids are actually dying of malaria, and why should this be, and how odd. And the advantage, perhaps, of my having not been an Africa specialist, but a development generalist, which is what I am, was helpful, because having so much malaria wasn't something normal at all. It was weird. I mean, I hadn't seen malaria in Bolivia. Of course, you don't see it at 13,000 feet above sea level. And I hadn't seen it in India, and I hadn't seen it in China, and it didn't loom large. It didn't exist in Poland and so forth. And it was neglected completely as just normal background noise for Africa. And so a little bit of the comparative perspective played a big role for me, and just eyes opened was my other point, that when you see a big crisis and you say, this isn't right, you're probably right that it's not right. And things that shouldn't be actually shouldn't be. And so it's worth trying to understand why they are and how odd it is And why should 1 or 2 million children die of a disease that's 100% treatable? That's weird. Except if you're trained, if you have trained incapacity, as long as you're not so much trained to be incapable of seeing this, it's weird. And so keep your eyes open to weird things, because weird things actually don't have to be that way. They can actually be changed. And it may take some work, and it surely takes understanding. It took me many years to dig my way out of a lot of mythology and misunderstanding and confusion and lack of data about why this malaria burden was not being faced by the world. And actually, it's only 2 weeks ago that I was able to stand at the United Nations while the Secretary General announced a comprehensive plan to control malaria by the end of 2010, a real breakthrough. It took many, many years of a few of us working on that at a high level, because it actually isn't right that it wasn't being tended to, but to understand the morass that led to that neglect and to address it still takes time, and then even an announcement is not the end of the story. It's just, in some ways, the beginning of the next phase of the story. So there are a lot of things to do. People are hungry that shouldn't be hungry. Children are dying, 5 million a year in Africa, 10 million a year worldwide, of completely treatable conditions. That's a lot of deaths. People are living without the most basic needs, like safe drinking water. This is crazy. I mean, we do not have to have a planet like this. And of course, people say it's naive to say so. I think it's naive to say not. Of course, there are reasons why it's not so easy to get global cooperation that's needed to solve these problems. There's a lot of mythology, cynicism, noise, confusion, costs of cooperation, and other kinds of transactions costs that have to be solved and overcome. But these problems are addressable through what we know and through the will to address them. So that's what I'm trying to work on. As my eyes get open and I understand better, and more as my expert friends tell me, how can you help on this or that? That's the kind of engagement that I think we can do. So that's a long-winded answer, but just to get us started.
One over here and one over there. So, Dr. Sachs, if you would recognize, if you have a question, raise your hand and someone will pass you a mic. We have to do it this way because we're taping.
Great. So, please. Well, let's start here and then come, yeah, next. Just tell me who you are, what program you're in. Yeah. That's you. The cue will be you'll be holding the mic.
Great. My name is Christian Beadle. I'm at the Brent School of Environmental Science and Management, and I'm in the eco-entrepreneurship program there, and we're looking at how to apply social and environmental considerations to business, and wondering what you think is the role in the private sector in fulfilling like public needs, and whether that can take on the gap left by governments.
Yes. I think we all sense that the boundaries between the public, the private, the civil society, and the individual spheres are somewhat blurred, and they are. But I think it is right to think in general about business oriented towards profits, and that's its core role, and that significant and sustained deviations from pursuing wealth maximization are not compatible with being a business. And so things that businesses do have to be within a context of the business as a business. in that context, I think there's a lot that businesses can do and need to do. First, they should obey the law, and that would be a big step forward for a lot of businesses, including our vice president's former, maybe even current business of Halliburton. They should also, in my view, not try to change the law through... I think there are boundaries in proper business behavior, which we could discuss on lobbying and truth-telling or not truth-telling and disguising evidence and many other things which are part of corporate responsibility, which I believe are a core part of doing business. But within the realm of a law-bound business, I think... From the point of view of business strategy, there still is a large range of possible actions, some that are rather good for business and some that are rather dangerous for business. Our public policy lags behind our regulatory environment, and our public policy definitely lags behind social needs. So, in the case of climate change, for example, we know that the market economy cannot by itself handle the problem of climate change because improperly and incorrectly it is free to put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere right now. And at a minimum, we're going to have to move to a business or economic framework in which there's a tax or regulatory limit on emitting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. This is basic public economics. We're not there yet because we have to end this particular presidency and start up with the next one in order to get there. But once that happens, we will get there. If you're a business that's involved in, as all businesses are, in using energy, and if you happen to be a business that's involved in a sector that's a heavy user of energy, maybe you're even a utility, a power company, or you're in heavy industry, as just core business strategy, even though it's not against the law and even against the market to emit carbon dioxide right now, it does make a lot of sense to realize, if you're keeping your eyes open, that within 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years, being a heavy carbon emitter is going to be a significant liability. So from a strategic point of view, you'll want to invest ahead of that. And so what is corporate social responsibility in that case, since you don't have to clean up your energy practices necessarily, you may still choose to do so within a certain boundary because you know that regulation is coming and it will be advantageous for you to get ahead of the curve rather than building out investments that are going to last 30 or 40 years and then penalize you later on as real public policy changes and you end up paying a significant cost for that. It's also the case these days that your investors, potential investors, may force those kinds of decisions. It's not really possible in the United States right now to finance a traditional coal-fired power plant because the investors are worried about ultimate liability of a power plant that will last 40 or 50 years. In the same way, there are other things that you might do because even though there's a gap of what's legally required, you can suspect that that gap is a lag between the real need and the political system closing that gap. And a lot of corporate social responsibility falls into the category of responding before you're forced to respond and getting ahead of the curve. And from a purely mercenary economics point of view, you could just call that good profit maximization, but with a far-sighted attitude. But it does fit under a corporate social responsibility viewpoint because you're moving ahead of where you have to go. I would say similarly, sometimes businesses that decide to do good things because they get a reputational return. That's also, in a way, profit maximization, and so it might not be distinguished from normal business practice, but it's just smart behavior. A good example, I think, is the company TNT in the Netherlands, which is the big logistics delivery company like DHL and UPS. And Peter Bakker, the CEO, tells a nice story that when he became CEO of TNT, he asked, what are we doing for our external affairs division? And the main thing they were spending money on was putting decals on stock cars for Formula One racing. And that's how they were advertising, in essence. He said, don't you think we could do something a little bit better than that? And he pressed his public affairs division, and they decided that they would partner with the World Food Program because WFP needs logistics support in the case of emergencies, and this is a logistics company. And they partnered, and they branded themselves as the partner of the World Food Program. And disasters came, and they did wonderful things. Wonderful things. And then they told the story of it also. And as he said, they've never made more money, won more awards, had higher company morale. There was no trade-off of doing good things. So it's a good corporate strategy, and it's a wonderful example of what is often true in life, that you can do well by doing good, and there's nothing cynical about it. It's a good choice of understanding how a business can act. But I want to push it another level forward, which is that companies can do things that go beyond all of that. There is a difference between a company saying, we'll get ahead of the curve, and a company saying, we don't know where the curve is, so we're going to lobby against controlling carbon dioxide emissions, or we're going to, try to spread doubt or even misinformation, which a lot of our big companies have done in the last 25 years. That I regard as way off the edge and absolutely appropriate as a target for serious opprobrium and for society to try to impose high costs on such companies, reputational costs. And that comes in a variety of ways, avoiding their products, giving the company a bad name, lawsuits which may or may not go anywhere, and imposing costs on companies when they try to recruit, because people actually don't like to work for such companies necessarily, and so it can be a major cost for recruitment. Now, there's another step forward, and that's the proactive part. There are many things businesses can do within the sphere of business consistent with the bottom line, not even necessarily for reputation or anything else, that's a real choice for business. And I'll give, this one actually has a bottom line implication, but it's a good example in my view, in my own experience. Here came the new AIDS drugs, the antiretrovirals, and the combination therapy was proved in 1996, and it quickly was taken up at the end of the 1990s in the United States. There was no single person in a low-income country that was given access to those drugs through any kind of official or corporate policies into the early years of our decade, especially in Africa. And an interesting thing happened. Because these were patent-protected medicines, the price that they were selling for in the United States still is about $10,000 a treatment course per year. And it was deemed impossible at $10,000 to treat anybody in Africa, for example, and nobody was being treated. Turned out, however, that the actual production cost of these drugs 5 years ago was probably about $500 a treatment course, and now is about per year, and now is about $100 a treatment course. So better manufacturing, lower costs and so forth, and the prices come down to about 25 cents a day, even though the market price, as it were, or the retail price in the U.S. remains about $10,000, okay, because it's patent protected. So it's a temporary monopoly. So what did the companies do at that time? They, for a while, defended their patent rights when it was when there was an attempt in some places, including Indian generics companies and some other producers, to produce these drugs as generics around the patent. And they fought this. And there was an avalanche of bad publicity attacking them because, after all, people were dying by the millions. Now, it's a basic point about patents that they are a quite imperfect instrument. We give patents to give the incentive for research and development, but a patent is a what economists call a second-best instrument. It may be better than not having a patent, but it's a deeply flawed kind of public policy because the monopoly element means that people that should get what is needed don't get it because they can't afford paying the monopoly price. So here you had a price of $10,000 in the U.S. market and an actual production cost, maybe a 20th or a 50th of that. And yet, for these poor people, they would only be able to get the drug at this high price. So what the drug companies worked out, and it was a discussion that I also had and some others had with the CEOs of the leading companies, was the following point. You could sell your drugs, I said, at the patent-protected price in the U.S. You're not selling anything in Africa anyway at those prices. How about making your drugs available at the cost of production for Africans and segmenting the market so that those drugs couldn't be re-imported to the U.S.? In other words, make them available at $300 in Africa and $10,000 in the U.S. Recoup the returns to your R&D. That, of course, has its own set of issues, but let's just go with that as our system works. But for the African context, give your drugs at a no-profit basis, at cost. And so that was a choice that finally was made in 2001 and 2002 by all of the U.S. pharmaceutical companies to segment the market. They ended up making no money in Africa, but also losing no money in Africa. It took leadership to say, here's a better system. We'll be proactive, but we'll get our costs covered at the now $100 per year cost, and we'll operate in this other market. Okay. Next step. That didn't quite work. I heard the head of Pfizer once complaining, you know, okay, we're doing this, but we ship the medicines and nothing happens. They don't even get to people that need them. And the truth is, of course, that even at $100, there's no system behind this to enable people. $100 is too much for people that have no money, first of all, and you need a logistics system, distribution, and so on. This was the origin of the Global Fund to Fight AIDS, TB, and Malaria, an initiative that Kofi Annan led, and I helped him write the plans for this back in 2000 and 2001. And the idea was to create a public-private partnership, and that's where I'm heading. The private sector still had to agree, okay, $100 per dose, but who was going to be the buyer now? It would be the Global Fund, in essence, or a government funded by the Global Fund to be able to provide all the back-end delivery. So here was a case where business had to be proactive. It had to take steps, but it also wasn't enough just to be a business. It had to form a partnership in a public policy area to actually make sure that the whole value chain was completed. And in many areas of public health, it's exactly like this right now. There are many diseases that are controllable, even subject to elimination, where the companies are either ready on a donation basis because their production costs are tiny, or at a cost basis to make their technologies available, but it's not enough. You need a public policy component combined with the private component to do it. And this is true of a whole host of worm infections, for example, that we're working on right now, hookworm, trichuris, ascaris, schistosomiasis, onchocerciasis, trypanosomiasis, lymphatic filariasis, leishmaniasis, which is a protozoan disease, and trachoma. In all of these, the drug companies are ready to do their part, but it's not enough. We need a public policy component. And it's no good yelling at them for them to donate hundreds of millions of dollars. They won't, and it's not their job, actually, in my view. Their job's to make money or not lose money, but to partner with those who can complete the value chain. Final word. So what do I say to a business about all of this? I say to a business, to all of them, besides the obvious of stay in the law, don't lobby for stupid things, don't make public confusion, don't hide facts, and all of those things, which we could elaborate on. And I say the following: do something active based on your technology or your special organizational skills, and figure out how to do it, and understand it may involve partnerships that you're not used to and operating in places that you're not used to, but it will be consistent with your business model. Good for your reputation, good for the morale of your workers, good for recruitment. Your suppliers and your customers will like it. And I'm not asking you for big charitable contribution. I'm asking you for you to put what makes your company add value in the economy to work in places that can use that special kind of knowledge. And pretty good run right now, I would say. I think it's almost fair to say that every company I've asked in the last couple of years to do something has done something. And usually on the value of some millions of dollars for a big company, plus a lot more thinking power and a lot more novel kinds of approaches. So it's proactive, but it doesn't in any deep way violate the business model.
Hi, I'm Howard Weinert. I'm the sociology faculty here. Thanks a lot for being here. We really appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
You started out a while back talking about debt and debt crisis. So I'm going to ask you a question about debt crisis.
Good.
And it's the U.S. debt crisis. Do you consider it to be a debt crisis that we are borrowing tremendous amounts of money from China and basically transferring it to Saudi Arabia? If it is a crisis, how might it be resolved? Obviously, it has a lot of the environmental implications and so on that you've already been discussing. So I don't think it's a technical economic question so much as a social economic, public economic question. And if it is not a debt crisis, when does it become one?
Right, good. Okay. Basically, the U.S. economy is a phenomenally productive economy. And it remains so to this day. It's the world's largest integrated economy. Our GNP, meaning roughly our annual production of goods and services, is about $15 trillion. And with our 305 million people, our income levels are roughly $45,000 per capita, which is not the highest in the world, but the highest for any large country in the world by far. It's also a phenomenally mismanaged economy at this point. It's mismanaged from the point of view of long-term sustainable development and basic equity. and I would say mismanaged even from the point of view of the short-term beneficiaries of some of the policies like the tax cuts of the administration. So I basically think that the part that our government gets involved in, that's many different aspects of a modern economy. So this is, I won't go into a long song and dance about all the different aspects of a mixed economy, meaning the role of government in what is to a large extent a market economy. But I think we're a very poorly managed mixed economy right now. Of course, we're much more free market, so-called, than most other high-income countries, especially in the lack of any responsible social policies. The amounts we spend for the poor, the amounts in all different dimensions, the care for insurance for people hit by shocks in our society is by far the weakest of all of the high-income countries. So that's part of our mismanagement. Our tolerance for inequality of income is by far the highest of all high-income societies. I think it has very deep roots in racial, ethnic, cultural heterogeneity. This is a country founded basically on the principle that you don't have to like your neighbor, and you certainly don't have to pay taxes for them. And I think it is a weakness of our society. I do believe that places that do pay taxes for their neighbors and where their neighbors pay taxes for them, like in Scandinavia, end up with much better social outcomes. But those are very homogeneous societies where perhaps it's easy to envision what that means. And it's harder for us because we really are a society steeped in the norm that leave me alone. I think it's a mistake for organizing a society because it's a myth to be left alone, especially in our complex world. And I don't think in the end people really want it. And I also don't think that the rich really benefit in any serious way from it in terms of what would be real well-being other than perhaps short-term money in the bank. We also have seriously mismanaged our fiscal policy as a result of this. The war is so unpopular, or the war was tolerable for the American people because basically for a large part of the population it didn't affect them. No draft, no tax, you know, it was a freebie. Not for the poorer part of our society, but for the middle class and up. And Bush would never have put this to a vote in the sense of a draft, that's for sure. That would have been the end of the war within about 3 hours. And nor for a tax, because that also would have been the end. Oh, you mean we have to pay for that? Hell no. But we weren't asked to pay for that. So the whole thing was financed without any fiscal backing. And we know that the tax cuts were also just the crudest and grossest acts of short-term grab in a political system that, you know, drips with money. And the very nice book by Ron Susskind, The Price of Loyalty, has a great illustration of when even George Bush, I don't know what it means because I don't think we can fathom his thinking processes, but at some point early in 2003, they're going around the table and Paul O'Neill, who's just about to be fired as Treasury Secretary, is saying, I don't think we need another tax cut. And Bush says, actually, yeah, we just did that, didn't we? And Cheney interrupts and says, we won, we're having the tax cut. And it is a stunning vignette of the profound irresponsibility of this particular government, which is the worst in our history, I think. But you have an unpopular war, you have a really wildly wrong-headed social policy also that Bill Clinton did not do much to strengthen, in fact, weakened on average. That was his triangulation, was to just go part of the way in undoing what remained of the social safety net. Then these tax cuts, and it added up. Then one final step, which was the financial market deregulation and a policy of always pumping money into the economy whenever there seemed to be an economic slowdown coming. For instance, after the dot-com bubble burst in early 2001, and then especially after 9/11. And the idea, I think, was that a government that has so little legitimacy to begin with and is doing these policies because they can basically get away with them was always desperate to keep the economy revving as much as possible as well. You add all of this up, it turns out that it drove us both from a fiscal point of view and a national point of view into a very low national saving environment, basically where our national saving rate plummeted. Our net national saving rate, net of depreciation, essentially went to zero. And our saving, therefore, couldn't cover even the modest levels of investment in the country. And that means you borrow from abroad for the war and the personal consumption spending. And so we borrowed several percent of income each year in this administration from foreign investors. A lot of the ultimate creditors were actually the central banks of Asia, which accumulated vast amounts of U.S. Treasury bills as their foreign exchange reserves. So China's sitting on $1.5 trillion of foreign exchange reserves, and the Asian central banks on about $3 trillion of central bank reserves. That's actually not a small amount of money, $3 trillion, even for a macroeconomist. Billions, that's nothing. But trillions, you know, we should still count trillions, actually. They're not yet rounding error. And so we ended up borrowing a lot. Now, it's not bankruptcy, and it's not a debt crisis like Bolivia, where the debts were 200% of GNP or more. So in this quantitative sense, we're still rich. It's eating out the foundations. It's termites eating the foundations of the country rather than the whole structure in utter collapse. I think when you add in one more factor, which is that the aging of the population means that we're going to have more and more needs for spending in areas like healthcare and others, and we've taken zero precaution for that. The extent of the implied liabilities of government get added on, and our burdens of fiscal irresponsibility become greater when we think not only about the cash flow gaps, but about the future. So what do I recommend myself? First of all, we absolutely, these Bush tax cuts will all be eliminated, and there'll be a little blip of irresponsibility in history, kind of a party for absolutely no use at all. We will have to actually raise taxes even beyond that, because we'll have public obligations that need to be fulfilled. Our total tax burden in the United States is about 33%, 17% or so now at the federal level, and then the rest at the state and local level. In Europe, it's 40-some percent. In the social welfare states, which I happen to admire as ways to run an economy, it's almost 50%. Doesn't mean a collapse. It means you get real public services. You don't have a profound underclass. You have public goods. You have a very high, much less inequality of income, much more equality of investment in human capital, the nutrition, the health, and the education of the population, and a more robust democracy as well, contrary to what Hayek said when he said that doing all of this would undermine democracy, put us on the road to serfdom. It turned out to be, I think, not only not right, but at least to some extent the opposite, that a pure, not pure, hardly pure, but a more free market approach with vast inequality is more threatening to democracy than high tax rates and a social welfare state, which can allow a more robust democracy because of more equality within the society. So the answer, in my view, is it's not too late, but this was, I think, the worst administration in American history. I say I think because I'm not sure about James Buchanan, who led us drift to civil war, and Warren Harding really was a bummer also. But aside from those two, I'd say that George Bush fits squarely within this category. We can expect something better soon.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.